Christine Lotti is an Academy, Emmy, and Golden Globe award-winning actress and director. For decades, she has captivated her audiences through iconic roles in Chicago Hope, Running on Empty, Housekeeping, and Justice for All, Law & Order SVU, and The Blacklist, just to name a few. Now in her new book, True Stories from an Unreliable Eyewitness, she channels her creativity inward to share her own story for the first time on the page. In this essay collection, she focuses on three major periods of her life: her childhood, her early journey as an actress and activist, and the realities of her life as a middle-aged woman in Hollywood today. Again, the new book is True Stories from an Unreliable Eyewitness, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Christine Lotti to the roundtable this morning. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm a huge fan of your work, and I am a huge fan of this book, and I thank you very much for taking the time out to talk to us. How long have these various essays been in your mind, been on your mind to want to share with other people?
I started writing them about 3 years ago I was in almost my mid-60s, and I had hit this tsunami of ageism that was really kind of shocking. I mean, I didn't really think there was a shelf life for actresses, even though that's really naive of me, but I didn't really, I guess, fully understand what that meant. So I was despairing because I thought, well, there's no more good roles right now, and this, I feel like I'm at the top of my game, so what am I going to do? So I had a lot of friends and my daughter, feminist daughter, who said, quit waiting around for other people, men, to hire you and go create your own stuff. So I did. I thought maybe these stories might be monologues at first, and maybe they would turn into a one-woman show. I didn't know, but here we are, and they are all put into a book.
Here is a line from the book. I am a middle-aged actress in Hollywood that's like saying you're mold, toxic and invisible. Hollywood's glass ceiling of ageism is virtually unshatterable. How do you believe that, in the sense that it cannot be shattered?
I think it is being shattered now, but I think it's taken a long time, and I think we're just getting cracks in the ceiling. It's not broken. We have one show on television about older women, Grace and Frankie. That's it. And there's a lot of women's stories that we haven't heard yet. They're important stories, like a lot of stories about people of color we haven't heard yet. We need to hear these stories. The film industry, TV industry, it has been historically white men producing shows about white men, written by white men, for white men. You know, it's been that. So this is all wrapped up also into Time's Up in the Me Too movement, and I think it's a really thrilling time in our culture as well as our industry.
Talk a little bit about the marketability, in the sense of the people, if they do these stories for a different audience, for people of color, for older women, for older men, there is a market there, correct?
I think so. I mean, last time I looked, baby boomers are, you know, at the top of their game. There are a lot of them. There are a lot of women, a lot of men, and they want their stories told. They want to see themselves up on screen.
So is it ultimately that it is, as you say, you think there's cracks, but then where do we go from here? What is the next step? Is there a roadmap in any way, shape, or form of where you go from here at this moment?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that more and more women are getting into positions of power, into hiring positions. I know within the industry, I talked to several producers. For example, the other night, I talked to a theater producer on Broadway, and she said from now on, she's going to have parity in all her hiring, so the stage, the set designer, the costume designer, all the way down the line, there's going to be at least half women. And, I'm developing a dramedy. Who knows who will buy it. I hope that like a cable company or a streaming company will buy it. But it's about an older woman who's being told to go out to pasture and become invisible. And she tries valiantly and often very foolishly to stay visible. So, I mean, and I think more and more women are just saying, I'm not going to sit around and be dependent on others to hire me. I'm going to produce, direct, write, star, and, create opportunities for other women.
The name of the book is True Stories from an Unreliable Eyewitness, subtitle A Feminist Coming of Age. When do you feel those feminist tendencies started to emerge?
For me, I had no clue what that even meant. I just thought the way it was is that I grew up in a very 50s archetypal kind of patriarchal household where my dad was the breadwinner and he was the boss and my mom was the stay-at-home mom and the housewife. And there was a real hierarchy of power. She was, from everyone's point of view that I could see, especially my own, she was second class to my dad and just not as respected. And that was typical of all my girlfriends' moms as well. So when I went to college, I was kind of a clone of my mom and a Republican like my parents. I didn't know any better. And then it was the Vietnam War, and there was the draft, and there was the protests and all the student activism. And most importantly to me at that time, developmentally, was there was the second wave of feminism. And I suddenly learned that, oh, this is not the way it just is. This is because of something called misogyny and sexism, and suddenly I saw it lurking everywhere where I hadn't even been aware of it. I just knew that something was wrong.
And you felt that grip, and did you think that there was something that you could do about it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just knew that suddenly, I mean, I'd always thought that women were, I was a real gal's gal, like women, my women friends were really important to me, but suddenly I saw women as sisters, and as we were going to help each other through this, because alone we're not going to make it. United in power. And feminism became my life jacket, the way in which I was going to navigate through a world that I perceived to not really like or respect women that much.
You threw a drink at Jimmy Walker on stage because he made a comment about your breast size.
Yeah, I did. I was a waitress at the Improv, and I didn't want to, no one could call me a girl in those days. That was a real, you know, it was a real derogatory thing if you called a woman a girl. It still is. You shouldn't do it. But I was very, very sensitive to all that stuff and was determined not to be objectified. And I didn't want to wear skirts or dresses. I downplayed my sexuality. I was no makeup. I mean, all that. I was really determined to be valued for something other than the way I looked.
And that didn't really change, did it? I mean, I guess it became a little more refined. You worked for food, but there's still that fundamental belief.
I worked for what? I'm sorry.
I said that you worked for food. You know, you still worked, right? You did what you had to do to get the job in the sense of going through the system, but you still held those beliefs, correct?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I turned down jobs that I thought were demeaning to women, and then I had to take some because I had to pay the rent. You know, wasn't just a virtuous, you know, perfect feminist. I just had to keep working and hopefully choose roles that portrayed complex three-dimensional women. But no, sometimes I had to pay the rent, and of course, you know, did parts that were not so great.
When you take those parts, does it show in the work?
No, because I find a way to convince myself that they're unbelievably complex, and I'm determined to have them be, you know, not sex objects and really living, breathing human beings. And in fact, I rationalize in so many ways. I did one horror movie that I'm not even going to name, but the director convinced me that it was a feminist thriller. It was a psychological thriller, and it had nothing to do with that. It was a horror movie. It was kind of a slasher movie. It was just so violent, and I remember being on the set, and I trusted this guy. I thought, well, yeah, we're going to make a feminist thriller. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I hear him on the set saying, more blood, bring in more blood. And so I thought, oh, boy, I let myself be duped once again.
When you think of the shows, have there been, because you get the sense in the book that there were shows that you were doing that you felt were really good but just never caught on, which I guess is the life of an actor, but it's things, the ones that got away, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think about Jack and Bobby, which was a series that I loved that dearly.
Show. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you do you remember that?
I love that show.
Yeah,
so
and
much.
I think it was ahead of its time. I thought it was maybe on the wrong channel. It was on the WB at that time. I think it was a WB, but anyway, it was just the wrong fit for that show. And you know, everyone goes into making a movie, whether it's a horror movie. I think pretty sure whatever the genre, whatever the outlet, in whether it's film, a play, TV, cable, whatever. But everyone goes in, I think, thinking it's going to be fantastic. I think you have to, with that kind of dedication and that kind of optimism. At least I do. I always think it's going to turn out amazingly well. And then, you know, it's out of your control. You have maybe too many cooks in the kitchen and too many network people giving notes and too many, maybe the writers are being noted to death. You never know what goes into the final cut of something.
I see you on television. I think of you as very active in your career. Do you still feel, though, that it's tough for you to get a job?
It's tough for me to get a job that excites me.
Okay.
That's the truth. I can get a job. That's, I mean, I think there are parts that I know there are parts I can play and, but they don't excite me. So what I did last fall, which was maybe one of the greatest roles of my career, was I went back to off-Broadway and did a play called Effing A. I can't say it probably on the radio station, but you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
It's written by Susan Laurie Parks, a Pulitzer Prize winning playwright. And it was a phenomenal stretch. It scared me. At this stage in my career, if something doesn't scare me, then I think there's something wrong. It should scare me. It should challenge me and stretch me, because why else do it? I mean, you know, of course, to pay the rent still, but it was an extraordinary challenge, and I'm so grateful to have had that opportunity.
What is it about a piece of work that can scare you, that is out of that comfort zone, that makes you think, oh, okay, this is exciting?
Well, for example, this character was based on the Scarlet Letter, the Hawthorne Scarlet Letter, loosely based. And this character was I had no clue how to play her. Let's put it that way. I couldn't rely on any of my old tricks. I had to do a ton of research. I had to really find what this person needed, what she wanted, of course, I do that with every character, but she was from a totally different past, a different economic background, a different everything. What had happened to her, the tragedy that had befallen her was way more than I could even imagine. So there was a lot of just stretching of my imagination. And I want to know that I love knowing that I have no clue how to play her at first.
And can you do, so once you know that, is it possible at the end of that run to find something that is similar, to find something that scares you? And is that extremely difficult, or is the stuff out there and it's just difficult to get the money to do it?
It's both. I think, you know, there's in films today, there's probably two roles a year for an older woman. The great roles. I'm not getting those parts. It's Meryl Streep, and God bless her, I think she's a national treasure. But there's just two, you know, and there should be 100 on television and film. And they are hard to come by. That's why I keep trying to create now. I'm a late bloomer, to keep trying to create my own projects, I'm trying to develop and direct more film, and create roles not only just for myself, but for other women whose stories I don't feel are being told.
When let's look at the Academy Awards this year of somebody like Laurie Metcalf or Frances McDormand or Allison Janney. I mean, these are women, you're in that club, right?
Well, I like to think of myself in that club. Those are three friends of mine, and I think they're all extraordinary, and I'm thrilled they had those opportunities. I think that they are hard to come by, and the fact that they all got them is a miracle and to be celebrated.
And I guess that's my point. We should celebrate that, but because that happened this year, does that mean that that can and will happen next year.
No, that's the problem.
Yeah.
I think it was a really great year and a lucky year in some ways, that all three of those that you mentioned are older women, and they were all, just extraordinary parts. And that's just, it's rare. And again, it's just more of those parts have to be written and produced and financed. Those stories have to be told. And it may take more women in power to get those stories told.
When you do something like the Good Fight, which I saw you on recently, mm-hmm. when you do something like that, is that you could have a role in a series if you wanted, right?
You mean a lead role in a series?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, whether it's going to be good or not, I don't know. But no, frankly, there aren't many series on TV that center around an older woman. I mean,
right.
That Christine Baranski, that is a fluke. That show and Grace and Frankie maybe are the only ones. So to say I could have one if I wanted one, no, that's not really true.
Right.
And then to say further that it's going to be a complex, interesting part, definitely not true necessarily.
Yeah, I understand that part. I guess I just think of you as for bringing in an audience. And is there something to the idea that we as an audience like you, we enjoy watching you, we know you? Those all seem to be pluses. I guess that's the part of the equation I don't quite understand. Meaning that it would seem that it would behoove someone to give you a series because people know you, people like you. It would seem like that would be a no-brainer. And I guess that's where the disconnect is of what I don't understand as to why somebody wouldn't want you or hire you.
Well, I'm with you. I don't get it either. I sit home sometimes and think, why? Why am I not in a great role in a great series that I love and I'm proud of and that challenges me? So what I did is I decided to create my own or collaborate with a writer to create my own. And so we have developed this dramedy about an older woman who is being told to go out to pasture and become invisible, and she tries valiantly and often very foolishly to stay visible. So that's a character I can really relate to, but it's really funny and it's topical, and I think it's also very moving and poignant. So we'll see. It's out to a couple of buyers now. We'll see if someone buys it. But I think I've got all my fingers and toes crossed that this might be the one. We'll see.
Given that we are in this moment, not only the Me Too movement, but also what many are calling a golden age, a second golden age of television, that
right.
If you put the two together, that you have opportunities there.
That's what I think. I think the timing could not be better for this show. We've gotten a lot of passes so far. We haven't gone to the networks yet, but companies, buyers like Amazon and Hulu, they're saying, well, we have so many of these projects already in development. And I'm thinking, okay, where are they? And call me when you want to cast them. I mean, where are these projects about older women? I don't know. They're claiming they have them, or maybe they just didn't like mine and they just passed and they made up a reason. Who knows? But yeah, it seems like perfect timing now. So I think I'm optimistic that we're going to sell this.
In reading the book, even though there's just some wonderful stories in the book, and you're telling of your childhood, you're telling of your career, it seems that you still genuinely enjoy being an actor.
Oh my God, yes. I love it. I love it. And again, like this past fall when I did that play in New York, Effing A, I was in heaven, and it was challenging, and there were dark nights when I thought, what was I thinking? I can't do this, you know, those horrible dark nights when you really take a risk, and then you figure out a way to do it, and it just makes you feel so satisfied. I love it. I love doing The Good Fight. I mean, that part wasn't huge, but it was
right.
Fun and comedic, and I love being on that set. That set is so fantastic. The first time I worked on The Good Fight, I looked up and I saw 150 extras, all people of color, all dressed in really beautiful, you know, lawyer outfits. And it made me weep. I mean, not copious tears, but yes. I welled up. I thought, I'd never seen anything like this. If there's parts for, you know, people of color, they're often, you know, well, they're maybe the janitor or there's the bad guy or the, you know, it's, I mean, you don't see 150 extras, all people of color. You just don't. And it was such a testament to Michelle and Robert King's vision to create a show like this. And I just was so proud to be part of that.
I'm loving that show because I think it shows what many of us are doing, especially in the Christine Baranski role of living through the administration that we're living through, that you have to go to work, but there are just days you want to feel like crawling into the fetal position and going into your
yes.
bed.
I love that they're dealing with those issues because you're right. We all are having to live that kind of duality of, on the one hand, getting through our days the best we can with hope and you know, productivity and optimism, and then you look at the news and you just, you know, you just want to curl up in the fetal position.
Well, the book is a delight. It is entitled True Stories from an Unreliable Eyewitness, A Feminist Coming of Age. It is published by Harper. Christine Lottie, what a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Christine Lottie's new book is True Stories from an Unreliable Eyewitness. It is published by Harper. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.